Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. On this podcast, we do like to discuss the macro and asset allocation views of the UBS Chief Investment Office, as well as those of our third-party asset manager partners. Joining us for the conversation today, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, the Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with the UBS Chief Investment Office. We're excited to welcome back for his second appearance with us, Jason Thomas, the head of global research and investment strategy at the Carlyle Group. So with that, Jason Dreho, Jason Thomas, thank you both for dropping by and for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts on the markets, the macro landscape, and of course, your thoughts when it comes to positioning. So a lot to cover. Let's jump right into it. Jason Thomas, to begin, can you take a few moments at the top to share with our listeners, our clients, your thoughts on the trajectory of the U.S. economy through the second half of the year? Might we see a soft landing, a no landing scenario, or perhaps something else?
Well, thank you. You know, I've always tried to shy away from the concept of a landing. I think when that linguistic formulation was used last year, it was a way of people essentially saying, is there going to be a recession or not during this period when rates fall back to more normal levels? So it's more of, again, the notion of a landing. The implication, I think, was that there was this substantial downward adjustment in rates back to the levels that we became accustomed to in that decade between the global financial crisis and the pandemic. And I think that the lessons from the last 2 years had been that we have this upward reset in what it is, what a normal level of rates looks like. You know, is it 3.5? Is it 4%? I don't know, but that is some distance from where we are today. And I think given some data regarding slowing consumption, this mostly I would say younger, less affluent households, but certainly some signs of stress related to credit cards and again, an overall deceleration in consumption growth, coupled with some very modest rise in the unemployment rate. And then, of course, very favorable inflation data does seem to have positioned us for a rate cut. And I think the Fed had not wanted to cut or have the first cut right in advance of the election. I think the evidentiary standard to a September cut was somewhat higher than, you know, for the November or December meetings. But I think at this point, given the constellation of data we see, a September cut is more likely than not. And then, you know, I think that the next step is, again, calibrating the expectations relative to what a normal or terminal Fed funds rate is. I think when the markets get excited about a rate cut arriving, they very often start pricing many rate cuts.
So with that, Jason Dreho, having just heard Jason Thomas's economic outlook, can you now take a few moments to share with us the views of the UBS Chief Investment Office with respect to how the U.S. economy might evolve in the months to come?
Well, I think for most of this year, our view has been essentially that growth, inflation, and rates, both kind of a 10-year and the policy Fed funds rate, would moderate from elevated levels where they began the year. And so growth would fall from where it was in the second half of last year, like at 4%, something closer to around the trend level of growth of 2%. Inflation would continue sort of a disinflation trajectory towards back towards 2%, and ultimately those conditions allow the Fed to cut rates. So that's the view that we've had for a while, and based on the most recent data we've gotten for June, whether it's payrolls, whether it's inflation data, and even, yes, some Fed commentary, all of that is still very much kind of in place. So I think from a macro perspective, you know, landing or not, however you want to describe it, but definitely kind of a glide path from an elevated level to some sort of kind of lower level. And all the data that we see is kind of gives us confidence that's the view that's playing out. And while, you know, I would agree with Jason, sometimes this, you know, we use the term landing very kind of loosely and sort of casually, often not defining what exactly that entails, and everyone has their own interpretations. You know, I think it's interesting the way that, you know, given this is the language we're using, sort of, I'm going to stick with it a little bit. And just I want to kind of come back to something that you mentioned in terms of the, the low level of growth that people maybe had or rate in particular, going back to something that might have been more pre-pandemic, yet it's clear that it's probably not going to be those levels. And something I wrote about, you know, earlier and in the second quarter was, you know, maybe the economy's landed, but it's just landed to a level where growth and inflation in particular and also rates are just going to be higher than what people were assuming. I think the assumption a little bit was we'd go back to like 2% growth, 2% inflation, and therefore, you know, interest rates, the Fed funds rate will go back to about 2.5%. And as we move forward, it seems like at least the latter assumption, maybe the inflation assumption, that's probably not realistic. Growth is more debatable. Given that, where do you sort of see kind of the economy moderating to in terms of your level of normal?
Well, I think that what has been most interesting over the last year has been this concentrated CapEx boom. Of course, two main drivers, industrial policy, which is what has motivated to a large extent the additions of electric generating capacity, mostly solar and storage, also the construction of battery manufacturing plants, also, of course, semiconductor fabrication plants, and then also the AI shock and the almost insatiable demand for data center capacity. So if you look at the U.S. economy and its outperformance relative to expectations from 2 years ago, you know, as you can see in the IMF's most recent World Economic Outlook, almost the entirety of that is explained by this fixed investment, again, industrial facilities for the most part. And this is something that doesn't just explain the past. It's really, I think, going to be a driver of growth over the next 12 to 18 months. If you look at the planned or intended spending, both public company reports and other surveys, this is something that is going to persist. You add to that, of course, the infrastructure spending, the rebuilding of defense industrial stocks, that much of that associated with rebuilding the stocks that had been shipped to support allies in Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan. It does feel like this is an economy that is slowing. Again, on the consumption side, we see some weakness, very, very bifurcated. Again, I'd say, lower income, people struggling with the cost of living shock. But on the whole, this is an economy that it's hard to get to a point where you're really materially worried about recession risk, I would say.
I want to pick up on this point about, you know, the investment that you cited, like, you know, the surge in CapEx in certain pockets. And it's a view that kind of helped, as our thinking is, the possibility of what we classify as a roaring 20s scenario. When I mention that term, people often have in mind, like, you know, stock market bubbles and things of that sort, which is not kind of what we define it, or at least the way we've been defining it. But something more along the lines of an economy that, you know, GDP growth could be like 2.5% or plus. Inflation is somewhere between 2-3%. Fed funds rate somewhere between 3-4%, and in 10 years around, you know, 4%. And we first did a big kind of presentation report in November of 23, suggesting like this is very much in play. And then just a few weeks ago, in late June, we did an update where we kind of, you know, the subtitle of the report was like, you know, the roar is getting a little bit louder. And the idea is when we looked at, you know, these investment trends, the things that you pointed out, like there's definitely sort of a pickup in certain pockets. It's not kind of necessarily a broad-based pickup in CapEx. A lot of developments in AI, you know, maybe playing out, at least on the investment front, faster than anticipated. When we looked at those kind of factors, we think going forward, the potential that could persist, but also have, you know, productivity benefits. That's the key to kind of lifting kind of growth and getting this more, you know, kind of elevated environment. Also, you know, maybe a little bit more inflation, but also higher rates. You know, I'd say it's not our base case, but the probability has risen. It's kind of like, say, 1/3, 40%. These become sort of arbitrary, but like enough that I don't see necessarily another case that's clearly a scenario that's more likely than this one playing out. Is that something you would describe to you? You're kind of more skeptical of, just, you know, given that what you said, I'm curious of your thoughts on how likely this could actually lead to, you know, not just 12 months or 18 months, but like a multi-year period where investment and therefore growth later on because of faster productivity could actually lead to higher level of growth, higher level of rates, maybe higher level of inflation going forward for on a multi-year perspective.
Yeah, I think it's quite reasonable to see that scenario play out. I would say that this concentrated, as you mentioned, this is not something where you look across the economy and you see equipment spending that is, you know, somehow markedly jumped up. It is, again, very much concentrated in data centers, the related hardware, and then, of course, the green industry, renewable energy, et cetera. I would say that there are questions that, that many are asking today about the return on some of this incremental capital. Recent commentary questioning whether people will look back favorably on the amount of CapEx that's going into data centers specifically. And it does feel in some cases that there is this desire to deter entry. I think that there are many of the hyperscalers who are investing because they do see the potential for, you know, what you could call monopoly rents from developing some of these foundational AI models. But again, I think part of it is just to essentially scare off potential competitors. And I think that, you know, again, it will be interesting to see the revenue streams that ultimately materialize, the use cases, and what the return on this capital spend will ultimately be. But I would say that it's very easy to talk oneself into the sort of upside scenario that, that you describe. But again, I think a key feature of that world is one where, you know, Fed funds rate of at least 3.5%, but, you know, maybe four and a quarter, is something that people will also have to incorporate. And at times, I do worry that people have almost a best of all worlds kind of scenario where they see the growth and downstream productivity implications of AI and this associated investment, but aren't really coming to terms with what that may mean about financing costs, base rates, and discount rates.
Just picking up on the point about, like, you know, the investment in data centers and people looking for returns on investment. It's in the past few weeks in the market, it's been simmering a little along, but it seems to have kind of picked up most recently about investors starting to say, are we actually going to see some sort of return? Like, is this also investment going to lead to, you know, fat more profits for some companies, you know, other implications sort of for other companies in the economy? I guess, do you have a kind of a view on, is that, I mean, it's a fair question to ask, but are you kind of on the camp of, like, being maybe a little bit skeptical, or my kind of view would be that this is still early innings and there's going to be ebbs and flows. And if you look at, like, do you expect results in the next 6 months, that might be too soon versus 3 years from now. But I guess just curious if you have a inclination, whether you're sympathetic to the view or a little bit more like, no, let's just give this time to play out.
What I would really, when I think about this, I separate the decisions of management teams from investors. So, you know, I think management teams, it's like the, you know, the old adage from the general theory about animal spirits, that this sometimes capital spending, capital budgeting on the part of firms requires some degree of, you know, it maybe not irrational, but some optimism that can't precisely be quantified. So I think this is very healthy to see these firms investing in what they believe to be transformative technology. And that is, they're behaving as they should. The question for investors is, what are the financial terms of that investment? And when you look at some of the valuations and, you know, just look at price to book and those sorts of metrics, there is probably a bit of the irrational optimism, again, which is appropriate at the management team level, that is seeped into the investors as well. And that's where I see some danger here. So again, you can delineate between the activities of management teams and their capital budgeting decisions from the capital allocation decisions, or, you know, essentially the multiples or the expected returns at which that capital is going into these investments. And in this case, you know, unlike mobile telephony or the internet investment backbone, broadband to the home in the late 1990s, much of that, of course, was debt financed. Much of this is financed by internally generated cash flow, essentially the equity. And so then the question are these the appropriate valuations for some of that equity, you know, on an incremental basis in terms of what's being financed? And that's where I would have questions.
I want to come back to that in terms of, like, investment locations and stock market outlook. But you're picking up on another point you've kind of mentioned earlier regarding the consumer, where you're definitely seeing sort of the lower income consumer being impacted, you know, by higher rates, by inflation, you know, their spending power has been impaired. I mean, I think of something as simple as, like, looking at, you know, airline travel. you talk to some people, and it's like higher income consumers, those who might own equities, they might own assets, and they're feeling relatively comfortable right now. Other consumers at the lower end, it's more of a strain. So it's almost a little bit of a K-shaped, to some extent, kind of recovery, evolution in the overall health of consumers. Given that, and you going back to kind of the rates maybe being a little bit higher for longer, how concerned are you that, some of the growth data we've seen recently, where there's been some moderation, data by and large has been surprising to the downside. Are you concerned that this could sort of slip? And, think like the labor market student example, there's like non-linearity, so things kind of cool gradually, and all of a sudden they kind of, fall over the edge to some extent. Whether that's the labor market, which of course, if that would happen, that would feed over to consumer spending. I mean, certainly a risk. How much of a risk do you think that is, that the economy could start to slow more rapidly because of the pain points and parts of consumer parts of the labor market?
Well, I think it is sufficient risk that it is going to spur Fed action. So I think that's important, that people have been too focused on the inflation data to the exclusion of other metrics. And obviously this is, it should be viewed in a multivariate context. So the fact that you see very encouraging inflation data at the same time that you see some of these risks manifesting themselves, weakening the labor market, the deceleration in consumption, that does make a very strong case for the Fed to act. And that sort of predicate for action was missing in the past. You saw encouraging inflation data, but it was coming in the context of an economy that was probably growing above trend. So, I think that this is going to spur action, and then we'll see where things stand, near year end. I do expect two cuts. So September, I think more likely than not, but if that gets pushed, then cuts in at the November and December meetings. And then I think by year end, we'll have a sense of where we are. And is it an economy where this was just a blip? And, maybe the Fed is going to be on hold a bit. That's certainly one outcome. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if a year from now we are still sitting at base rates in that, 4.6, 4.7 range. So two cuts and then, the data solidify and then that there's a willingness to wait before any subsequent move. Or, perhaps this is something that does lead to another, couple of cuts. But again, I think given what we just discussed about investment over the next 12 to 18 months, this is a situation where I think from my perspective, there's room for 100 basis points of cuts. But anything beyond that really would require a more material signs of weakening, which again, I think it's really premature to make those kinds of judgments. At this point, we've just seen sufficient data to spur Fed action. And then, 6 months from now, we'll have a better sense. But again, to have 14% year-over-year earnings growth, which is the bottoms-up baseline today from the median forecaster, at the same time that the base rates are going to be sub 4%, that strikes me as a confluence of events that's not particularly likely. If you believe this is a blip on the radar screen and things are going to, growth is going to persist around 2%, even slightly higher, well then it's important to dial back some of your expectations for the magnitude of the Fed's move over the next 12 months.
Yeah, if we get 14% earnings growth on a forward-looking basis of the S&P 500 and the 10-year, it's like at 3.8%, about 6 months from now, 12 months from now, I think the only way you kind of get the combination is some sort of immaculate disinflation situation where like inflation just keeps coming down, yet growth holds up, even like, that accelerates from like a little bit of a soft patch. It's possible, but it doesn't seem like it's the most likely outcome. And a point I'd pick up on it when I agree with you that, it's very possible that we get like kind of like it's called almost like a mid-cycle kind of risk management cuts, meaning like the Fed does 2, 3, maybe 4 cuts and then pauses. Like that's sort of roughly what they did in the 90s, had a rapid hiking cycle and then cut 3 times, held steady, and then the next move actually was a hike higher. Which when I look at market price and even frankly the Fed commentary, it's been so focused on when do they start and let's answer the path. And it does seem like when I look at the Fed's projections and sort of dot plots, it basically implies once they start, it's a quarter 25 basis point cut every quarter, basically until they get down to like 3.25. So it's very sort of methodical, which almost feels more like a plug, like kind of saying like, we don't really know what's going to happen after the next 6 months. Maybe we only do 50, maybe we do 100. Let's just kind of write that down. I think the market's kind of taking the lead. The market pricing is there, but there is definitely scope for the market, I think, to be realistic. If Fed might do 3 cuts, and that's all that's necessary in the cycle because the economy's doing fine.
Whether it's that would be a good outcome too. I mean, that's the thing that I would hope that's what happens, because that implies again that this little deceleration we've seen ultimately amounts to nothing. That all these CapEx plans, they're not scaled back. In fact, they may be increased. There may be further scaling up of the public investment in infrastructure, the actual outlays and deployment that supports growth. So I think that this kind of 2-3 cut scenario is one that we should hope comes to pass. And I just worry about, again, the markets getting ahead of themselves, or as you suggest, just following the Fed's lead as it relates to, is once they start, it's this domino of 25 basis points each quarter thereafter.
Turning to the markets and to investing, I would say the equity markets, the S&P specifically, is priced for good macro news, not necessarily great macro news. And I kind of base that on, if you look at what's been leading, it's been, you know, the tech sector, it's been a handful of stocks, which you could argue that that's been more of an AI-driven story, and that might be overdone. The rest of the markets, it's not necessarily pricing in, you know, a Goldilocks macro environment. And we saw what happened last week with the inflation data when it was better than expected. Small caps tend to be, you know, more economically sensitive. You know, they bounce back a lot. Maybe more from like a positioning perspective. But I think there's scope from a macro, there's more upside for equities, but you know, all I can take is the disappointment on the AI story to kind of work against that. When you factor that all in, maybe just thoughts on, you know, opportunities that you see, you know, 6-12 months or longer down the line, given sort of Carlyle's perspective on kind of looking like you're making long term investments in the private markets. What sort of do you like, what do you not necessarily like within kind of equities at this point in time, given the valuations, given sort of the macro backdrop that you've described?
Well, I think what's been fascinating about the first half of the year, you mentioned the concentration in the market gains. I think this is, since those are all tech companies, or, you know, they can be technically classified in other industries, but generally associated with the tech sector, there's been this presumption that tech itself has outperformed. And actually, what's fascinating is that if you equally weight tech stocks in the broad U.S. market, you could use, say, the S&P 1500, that's actually underperformed the equal weight of the market X technology. So it has been not just bifurcated market between these mega cap tech stocks and the rest, but also inside of the tech sector itself. And the key determinant there had been the cash generating capacity of these businesses. You know, higher rates have obviously not hurt any of these mega cap companies because they have enormous cash piles. In fact, if you look at net interest, it's increased because there's no net interest expense. They're creditors on net. You can contrast that, of course, as you mentioned, with the Russell 2000 or small caps, where this higher cost of capital, higher base rates has had a very negative effect. So, you know, I think that going forward, this is something that I think is a foretaste for what to expect going forward, that the companies that can reliably generate cash and can demonstrate that during this period of time and also have somewhat eased financing burdens from, you know, some of the rate cuts that are clearly coming in the next several months are where there's going to be outperformance. And I think that, you know, in private markets where we focus, it's going to be, I think, interesting to see where multiples normalize. There has been a pickup in activity in Q2. There's lots of optimism about transaction volumes, M&A volumes more generally picking up. But there is still a very large overhang of some of those very rapidly growing tech businesses acquired in 2020, 2021. And, you know, that they seem perhaps to have been designed for an era of very low rates, both because they're losing money in the short term. So, you know, you have an opportunity cost when base rates are zero, real rates are sharply negative. It's not quite as painful to fund losses as it is when base rates are over 5%, real rates over 2%. But you also then have the terminal value. What is that you know, those, that free cash flow that is expected to be generated out into the distant future, what is that worth in present value? And of course, that has declined significantly as longer-term yields have backed up. So there's going to be a benefit here as rates come down. But where are those multiples going to normalize? I think that's the big question I have. And thus far, at least if you look at public comps, there's some skepticism, you know, some of a sense at least that perhaps some of those multiples may have been more contingent on that zero rate finance environment than many may have expected.
That kind of segues to maybe a question, you know, regarding like the private equity market. You mentioned that there's optimism that M&A activity could pick up. And I think we're seeing a little bit of signs, you know, as the second quarter went on, like, that could pick up. So lower rates would help unlock it. And there's been some stuff has been on hold across different, you know, all sorts of corporate activity. We're waiting for like kind of the rate cuts to begin. But for somebody for private equity, I'd wonder how much also it needs the IPO market to open up, which is, it might take a little longer. And typically that's going to skew more towards, you know, riskier, more speculative companies, at least, newer companies that there's maybe they didn't have earnings before. And I can certainly saw a few years ago when rates went hard, non-profitable tech companies got hit very hard. They, it's a broad category, have not really come back in the way that the large cap tech companies have come back. So from how much would you ascribe to, yes, you need M&A activity to pick up, rates to go lower, but for, say, the private markets to really kind of have the activity to pick it up, you need exits, and exits were kind of required the IPO market to open up, and that may take, you know, a couple more quarters, you know, M&A picks up. Would you agree with that statement? Do you think it's like, you know, they, you know, without the IPO market functioning properly, it's tough for private markets to really, is the activity to pick up a great deal?
Well, IPOs are, of course, very important as an exit avenue, but you think of it as one third of a market, the other two thirds being strategic sales, and then also secondary sales to other private equity funds who may have ideas about what to do with the business, or, you know, in many cases, you have management teams that simply don't want to go public. So if there's no strategic buyer or that's not a direction they want to go, they want to find another buyer so that they, another private equity fund buyer, so that they can remain private. That's something that has really grown quite considerably. About 40% of our CEOs surveyed a couple of years ago suggested that they didn't want to be public company CEOs because just the amount of time that is devoted to serving as a stock salesperson and of course, the other issues with quarterly earnings and managing to that, those sorts of things. So, you know, an IPO market that does not heal, where issuance remains slow, is certainly not helpful. But again, there's quite a lot of other opportunities to exit. I think, to me, the big issue has not just been the level of rates, but also the implied volatility of rates. You know, it was not long ago where guesses for year-end 2024 base rates between 2 and 5% was sort of a reasonable range of where they would end up. And when you have implied volatility that creates such a wide range of potential outcomes, it's not surprising you have very wide bid-ask spreads. A seller who thinks that rates could fall by 300 basis points over a, you know, multi-year period could reasonably think that they would be crazy to sell at current valuations because financing conditions, if they improve, could mean that they could get a much higher price sometime in the future. So the real option to wait was very valuable. And I think that slowed activity materially. Now that the range of outcomes has narrowed, as people have become more anchored to base rates in, you know, that 3.5% to 4% range, you know, implied volatility from various swaptions averages now about, you know, slightly more than half of what it was not long ago, I think you have a narrowing of bid-ask spreads also and a willingness to transact. There's less fear of regret of being able to get that higher price in the future. And so I do think that that is also going to improve the willingness to transact in those secondary markets among strategic acquirers, et cetera.
That I would agree with. I think there was certainly the rates volatility has come down. Although I want to conjecture ahead is that the path for rates in the second half of this year was relatively narrow. If you think of the Fed funds rate, like either they're not going to cut at all, or maybe they cut two times. It's possible they could do more, but I think, you know, 0 to 2 was where the consensus. As we move forward, I think by year end, the debate will be very much along the lines of like where are those levels of neutral and normal. And while there's people I think are coalescing to the 3 to 4% range, you know, what does that mean for the 10-year? Maybe the 10-year should be at 4.5% or higher, and others would think it goes lower. So it almost feels like the debate is not so much where rates will finish this year, but more along the lines of like what level are we kind of landing to at some point in time we're kind of coming down to. And that could, I think, persist the volatility a little bit going forward. But I do have one final question just on the kind of the M&A side. And, you know, rates have been a factor, IPO exits have been a factor. I think strategic considerations, like, you know, where's the economy going, like, you know, companies wanting to make decisions of making strategic acquisitions. But how much do you think the kind of regulatory uncertainty, you know, approval process has been an impediment, if at all, to, you know, more activity? And could that, you know, post-election, whatever the results be, kind of unleash a little bit of maybe some pent-up M&A activity? There'll be like a clearer path of how regulation will evolve one way or another.
I think that has had an impact on a sector-specific basis. What I think the bigger impact has been is the rising geopolitical risk. And also some of this just naturally stemmed from what has been dubbed the supply chain crisis. Just the recognition that these globally distributed production networks had become too fragile. And many were sequenced, the production was sequenced in a way so that the failure of a component, part, other supply to arrive shut down everything downstream from that in the production process. And that just led to, you know, incredibly long delays and just enormous lost sales from the inability to produce. So there was already this movement, not just to reshore, but just to get greater control, have more redundancies, be willing to invest more to just minimize the risks associated with that fragile system that had come into being. And also, again, the geopolitical aspect means that people can no longer be agnostic about who their suppliers are. It can't just be competition based on price subject to the specifications of the OEM. It has to be much more control and understanding where every element is sourced. And this certainly is not going away. I think there will be you know, some greater clarity as time evolves. But I think that has been an impediment, or at least, you know, different acquisitions may all of a sudden introduce certain risks that may not have been so evident a couple of years ago. But as it relates to sector-specific issues, particularly energy, I think that the election is going to answer a lot of questions. There's also, of course, competition policy. That's another area. Different business combinations, the way that they've created some suspicion in recent months and years. I think that's another area where, you know, depending on the election outcome, there could be much greater clarity and lead to, you know, a pickup in deal volumes.
Well, Jason Thomas, Jason Dreho, thank you both again for dropping by How Should I Be Positioned to share with our listeners and our clients your thoughts on the market macro landscape, as well as views when it comes to portfolio positioning.
Thank you for having me.
It was a great conversation. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.